Blog Talk Radio.
And a great big hello and welcome. You're listening to the Palm Springs Savant and Company radio show. I'm Rick Rockhill, your host, right here, coming to you live from Sonoma, California, beautiful wine country in Northern California. And today's show is about, no surprise, wine. I have spent the weekend here in Northern California visiting some of my favorite spots in both Sonoma Valley and Napa Valley. And not only is it a passion of mine, a little bit of a hobby, but it's something I really enjoy and decided to make it a topic for this week's show. And I'm really excited that we'll be welcoming Jerry Padilla to our show. He's the assistant to the winemaker at Ledson Winery in the Sonoma side. So we'll be calling in a few minutes, and we're going to talk about wine. So for those of you who know a lot about wine or know nothing about wine, this show should be informative and have some interesting little tips and insights that you may find to be useful and interesting for yourself. For those of you who are listening from far away who are not familiar with Sonoma, you may not know this, but Sonoma Valley is the birthplace of California wine. And it's most people think of Napa Valley as the big wine center, and it certainly has grown to that. But this area of Northern California, it's the southeastern county, I guess, and it stretches from the San Pablo Bay, to Santa Rosa in the north, and it's really a lovely, lovely spot. So, of course, there is an incorporated city of Sonoma itself that's part of Santa Rosa, but there's lots of little communities that make up Sonoma Valley, Kenwood, Glen Ellen, and so forth. There's a number of Boyd Hot Springs and so forth. Anyhow, Sonoma is a lovely, lovely spot. So let's spend a couple minutes here before Jerry joins us to talk about wine. Wine, if you're not familiar, you should know that it's basically fermented grape juice, and it's something that's been around for a awfully long time. It's fermented fruit juice, if you will, that grapes are crushed, and then you add some yeast, and the yeast is what really is consumed, and it turns everything into alcohol, since we know and love and enjoy when we drink wine today. Lots of different varieties of grapes, different types of yeast that are all used, all the subtleties in making wine, and we'll hear a little bit about that with Jerry shortly. But wine is, as I said, it's been around a long time, thousands of years, and it's kind of been interwoven in history throughout the centuries. It's been part of agriculture, cuisine, civilization, and even humanity, really, as far as we know. It goes all the way back to 6,000 B.C., if you can imagine that. Way back, even in Europe, incredible digs have been discovered that show that all sorts of evidence of grapes being crushed to make this drink that was revered by so many. Even in Egypt, wine became part of history very early, and it was important in ceremonial life. It was a major part of Greco and Roman history. These very established wine-producing regions in Western Europe especially. Really, I think it was the Romans who invented the wine press, and that really brought wine into kind of, you know, substantial abilities for production and consumption. So it goes way back. And I think what people fail to remember is here in the U.S., for a very long time, we've been making wine, but we had very little respect. People around the world just never really thought that Americans could make wine. In fact, really, the grapes came to North America, the Americas, by the Spaniards, and, you know, we had been planting and doing different things over our history. Immigrants came here, had the skill, had the abilities, and we're working on growing grapes and turning them into wine for a very long time. But it wasn't until the latter half of the 20th century, really, it's only recent history, that American wines were thought to be surprisingly decent. And it was, I think, in 1976, actually, at the Paris wine tasting, that people said, hey, these wines aren't bad. And American wines then kind of developed the respect that they deserve. Part of that is, of course, that, the American palate, the tastes, what people were doing to make wine, what they were interested in drinking. The palates were developing. And while Europeans and other nations were had, you know, many centuries of wine drinking behind them to appreciate them and have a palate for wine, the taste for it, many Americans, particularly in the, you know, the early part of the 20th century, wine was not part of the normal custom. So at dinner time, people weren't drinking wine regularly. So there wasn't, you know, widespread demand for great quality wine, and that may have been part of, I'm just kind of surmising here, but may have been part of what delayed the development of really fine wines, or at least in a mainstream recognized level. So if you think that Americans aren't good at wine, you're wrong, because we do have a tremendous wine industry and some award-winning wines here in this country. But despite that, despite the fact the popularity of wine, the number of people who enjoy wine, there's an amazingly small percentage of the U.S. population that actually consume wine. And part of it is, I think some people are still intimidated by it. They think it's complicated, could be intimidating, and people think that you have to know a lot about wine to enjoy it, and that's just not true at all. I have learned everything about wine from just trial, testing it, reading, a little bit of research here and there, but I've learned that my nose is my best friend when drinking and enjoying wine. And so this is what I offer to you. My advice, if you want to give it a whirl, try some different wines. Taste them, smell them, enjoy the aroma with your nose, and just sort of let your mind wander. So it's really not that complicated, but it does take some patience and, as I said, some trial and error. This is probably a perfect time for us to welcome our guest on the show. I'm going to have the board op switch over to find Jerry Padilla. Are you with us, Jerry?
Hello, Rick. Yes, I'm here. Hey. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. Thanks for calling in. I appreciate it. While I introduce you to our listeners today, Jerry Padilla is the assistant to the winemaker at Ledson Winery in, actually it's in Kenwood, isn't it, in the Sonoma Valley?
Yes.
And Jerry, I've known Jerry a number of years. He's a very knowledgeable guy who has a tremendous perspective on the wine industry and winemaking and not only the technical side of it, but, you know, the things that people know and like to talk about. So I invited Jerry to be on the show today so that we could have some conversation, share some dialogue about this wonderful, wonderful beverage that so many people know and love. And one of my goals today, Jerry, is to spread the word so more people will come to appreciate the art of wine. So thanks for being on the show today.
Nice to be here. Yes, wine is definitely a beverage that we enjoy out here on a regular basis, and we're blessed to have this this region here, this microclimate and this soil, the two uncontrollable factors, and our job is to simply present the best that we can possibly do.
You know, that's a great point that you made there, because I was talking earlier before you joined us that for many, you know, long, long time, people, they're still happy there, Jerry?
Yes.
Okay. For many years, people didn't realize that California had any decent wines to it, and it was only more recent history that people realized, hey, these California wines are pretty good. What is it that makes Sonoma and Napa wines as good as they are? Can you explain or give us some insights into that?
Sure, yes. Wine, of course, there's two main ingredients, in my opinion, when it comes to quality wine. And one, of course, is the quality of the fruit, and the other would be the aging and the winemaking process. And I'm pretty sure that everybody's aware Napa and Sonoma Valley are ultra-premium locations now for great wines, and we have to thank Mother Nature. It's the weather, it's the air, the precipitation, the humidity, the natural rainfall, it's the dew points, it's all Mother Nature. She has created a wonderful microclimate, well, several different microclimates that the wine grapes love and thrive in, and it's our growing season. It starts in April every year, and we harvest in October, and we like to say every year is a great year in California, and some years are exceptional. So with that, also the soils, the soil volcanic soils out here really give us some intense flavors from all the nice varietals.
I've even heard somewhere, I might have it wrong, but I've heard that, in fact, California, SoCal, has perhaps a better microclimate for growing grapes than even some regions in Europe. And is that true, or is it just a myth?
Wow, I have to honestly say that all these grapes, a lot of these grapes came from Europe, from France, and I think that we have taken it to the next level. I think that with the help of UC Davis, the most respected research institution on the planet now, we've really come a long ways in terms of the growing root stocks, different clones, and I think that we have adapted and really have showcased a lot more flavors from the varietals, and I do believe that we get plenty of sunshine out here to ripen the fruit, and that's one thing I think they've always had a challenge with is getting the full ripening, and that really helps us to make excellent wines. We have the California sunshine.
Which makes a big difference. You mentioned the varietals, and it's probably a good place for us to start today. And again, there are people who are overwhelmed by, you know, all the different types of wines. They'll walk into a wine shop, and they'll just see so many different types, and they may not understand the basics. Could you take us through just an overview of the different types of varietals of wine and what to look for if they go into a wine shop?
Yeah, that's a loaded question there. I'd like to talk about some of the well-known varietals. There's probably over 100 different varietals. And if we got into, just some of the basics, I think that would be helpful for all our listeners today. To start off with white wines, I'd like to talk about a couple different white wine varietals. Sauvignon Blanc is probably one of my favorite white wines out there. And Sauvignon Blanc is the name of the grape varietal. We here in the U.S. are naming all the wines after the varietals, whereas in different parts of the world, you might have a wine named geographically. So that might cause a little confusion, and I just want to clear it up out here. When we put the name Sauvignon Blanc on a label, that is meant to give the consumers information, and it consists of at least 75% Sauvignon Blanc grape juice. So it's pretty easy to understand what you have. It's usually 100% when it comes to Sauvignon Blanc. But that's the name of the grape. And Sauvignon Blanc originated in France, right in the Loire Valley. And Sauvignon Blancs can have a kind of a grassy, almost herbaceous type of aroma. And that's a traditional style there. But I think that a lot of the California Sauvignon Blancs have mimicked the New Zealand style. They're much more fruit forward. They got all that tropical citrus, tangerine, just a lot more fruit. And Sauvignon Blanc is one of our solid wines that we produce out here, and it grows really well. So Sauvignon Blanc, also Chardonnay. Chardonnays are huge out in California here. We have quite a bit of Chardonnay vineyards planted, and Chardonnay loves the cool regions, and Chardonnay can be made in so many different styles. I just kind of want to briefly touch on varietals right now and not go into too much detail about the actual wine making. But Chardonnay seems to be a traditional wine that people would go to, and it's just a real nice apple pear. You get the oak, the toast, the creamy, the buttered flavors, and those are all stylistics of the winemaker. So you can choose on how to really make your Chardonnays, but I think that's an excellent wine that we can't fail to miss out on here. Another great wine, a white wine varietal, like Riesling, perhaps. People like Rieslings. That's a nice wine that originated in the, it's actually in the Alsace region in France. That's where the origin is. And that Riesling can be made in so many different styles. Sweet is a common way to produce it. Off dry, some people make a Riesling bone dry. Riesling is one of my other favorite white wines. So
the Rieslings will be a little sweeter. If you were to describe those three different types of whites, how would what would the taste be to the palate for the average person?
Well, the Riesling is definitely going to be your sweetest out of those three there. Sauvignon Blanc would probably be the next in line in terms of dryness there, and then Chardonnay is probably bone dry. That would be your biggest, richest, fullest body white wine. So when we're talking about white wines, you really are looking at textures on the palate. The Chardonnays are going to be richer, fuller bodied, more of that oily texture, where Sauvignon Blancs can come off as a lighter white wine, where you're going to get more of that crisp authority, more of that prickly sensation on the palate, and definitely going to offer you some nice refreshing flavors there. And Riesling is considered to be more of a, you know, it can be a sweet wine, so not too much dryness there. You're going to really have a nice, easy drinking, very approachable wine to sip on.
Now, so those are some of the whites, and what are your thoughts on the reds there, the typical, most common ones?
Well, Pinot Noir, everybody loves Pinot now, right? Yeah, Pinot Noir is always the lightest of the reds, and when I go through these red wines here, I'll pretty much take your palate through a natural progression, starting with the lightest of the reds, and we'll kind of move into some varietals that are bigger, richer, fuller-bodied. And Pinot is such a delicate grape. I'm just going to kind of mention briefly some of the varietal characteristics of each wine. Pinot Noir, when I think of Pinot, I think of soft and silky notes. Pinot Noir is just a gentle grape that really thrives in a cool microclimate. And out here in the Russian River Valley, one of our 13 appellations here in Sonoma County, and Pinot just does really good out there in the Russian River Valley. That's one of our go-to wines out here. And if you wanted to take your palate into something a little bigger, maybe a little richer, I really enjoy the Italian varietals like Barbera and a Sangiovese. Those two grapes are awesome. And if you're looking for even bigger wines, Zinfandels and Merlots, incredible Zinfandels out here. Zinfandel is one of the oldest varietals that have been established here in California, going back to the late 1800s. A lot of the Italians planted them, and they were used here in California for the missions. They're used for sacramental purposes, and we have access to a lot of these Zinfandel vineyards that were established over 100 years ago. And Zinfandels out here in California are amazing. They're just really...
They're among my favorites.
Yes, yeah. Zinfandel from Sonoma Valley, Dry Creek Valley, Russian River Valley. Those are ultra-premium appellations for Zin. And, of course, you know, you have your big red Bordeaux blends. We out here, we have lots of Cabernet Sauvignons, Cabernet Francs. We're doing some Malbecs, some Petit Verdot. We have a lot of great Cabernets out here. And Cabernet Sauvignon is the king of the reds. That would be your biggest, fullest bodied wine that has enough structure to be aged for years. So those are just a couple of my favorites right there.
Yeah, I appreciate that, because that does kind of put things in perspective for people. And you're going into a wine shop, and the basics, the ones that you'll find most commonly, and as you mentioned, there's many hundreds of different blends and varietals out there. But if you know those basics, you're probably doing okay.
Sure.
Now, are they all made similarly? Some of these things I've learned in my, you know, research and just talking to you, quite frankly, but for a lot of people, there's not a broad understanding of how wines are made or the differences between making a white or a red. But can you give us a brief explanation of how wine's made?
Of course, yes. Wines, there's basically all the juice is clear in the grapes. So in order to make a red wine red, start with the reds here, you have to harvest the fruit. Everything usually is picked by hand out here. And when the fruit comes in, we destem all the clusters. So you're only working with the actual berries. And once you have all the fruit destemmed, it goes into a crusher, and it breaks apart all the berries, releasing the juice. The juice is then in contact with the skins. We call that the maceration period, and it usually goes on for about 15 to 18 days. The skin contact is how we get all the red wines red. So in order to produce a red wine, you have to have a red-skinned grape. And with white wines, it's the exact opposite. You're using all your green grapes, and we're destemming the fruit, and it immediately goes into a press where you separate the skins from the juice. So all you're using with white wines is the actual grape juice. which is clear. And that's pretty much as simple as it gets right there. Red wines come from red skin grapes, and white wines are from the green grapes.
And the how about the storage and how long they have to be kept for, and how would you describe that process, the difference between white and red there?
Yes, with white wine, they're usually kept in a stainless steel fermented tank, and we go through a nice long slow fermentation, especially with our Sauvignon Blancs. That's what really keeps all that nice acidity, that beautiful fruit that and offers that crisp authority. So usually stainless steel for lots of white wines, such as Muscat, Riesling, Sauvignon Blancs, Viogniers. Those are all names of grapes. Pinot Grigio, same as Pinot Gris, by the way. The French call it Pinot Gris. The Italians refer to it as a Pinot Grigio. That's another one of my favorite white wine varietals. And the fermentation process can go on for at least a month or so. Usually what you're doing is you're bringing the temperature down in the tank to about 40 degrees. You want a nice, long, slow, cold fermentation there. And with Chardonnays, you have a few different options. You can try to ferment in a stainless steel tank, or the winemaker chooses to go right into a barrel. So there's two different ways to produce white wines. Typically, they're done in a tank. Chardonnay would be the varietal that usually sees oak. And these barrels are all imported from France usually. A lot of folks use French oak. They're considered to be the ultra-premium storage. And also American oak is very high quality. I've known winemakers to experiment with Hungarian oak, and it's an awesome process where you get to really see what the flavors from the barrel bring on. But white wines are not, they can be stored in a barrel for maybe up to a year, 6 to 12 months. You don't want to overpower all the subtle flavors of the grape. So you can leave a white wine in a barrel maybe at the longest for a year. Some winemakers may choose to go longer, but for the most part, it's most common to have a Chardonnay only for about 6 to 12 months. Now, with red wine,
so just a question, Jerry. That oaky flavor, sometimes people will describe when they'll drink a Chardonnay or something, that's coming from the barrel, is what you're saying.
Exactly. You're extracting lots of flavor compounds from those oak barrels, which are actually charred on the inside. They're toasted, and we, as winemakers, decide what type of toast we'd like to have. You can have a light toast, a medium toast, a heavy toast. It even gets so complex you can have a medium toast with toasted heads. So the barrels themselves are the other flavor compound that's contributing to all the wines. You have the wine grapes, and you also have the oak. Those are the two main ingredients in wine.
Okay, great. And now how about the reds? You took us pretty much through the whites, and that's very helpful because I understand the red process is different than white.
Red wines are considered more complex, definitely take longer to produce. And when you're bringing in the red grapes, we're destemming all the fruits, and like I said, we're crushing it, and the juice is with the skins. And after it finishes fermenting, it can last up to a month. What happens is you have the natural sugar from the grape. We introduce a yeast strain. The yeast actually consumes the sugar and produces alcohol. And a byproduct of that process, it's just called the fermentation process, primary fermentation, would be carbon dioxide, and also you have heat, and of course you get your alcohol. So during that process, what happens is these carbon dioxide bubbles are causing the skins of the grape to rise to the top. And our job is to keep that, it's called the cap. We want to keep emerging that cap into the juice. So we're constantly punching down the cap and doing punch downs every day, twice a day usually, depends on what varietal, and then also a pump over. You're taking the juice from the bottom of the tank and you're pumping it over the top of the tank to merge the cap and get more color extraction. So a lot more work goes into producing a red wine. And after that, once it finishes fermenting, all the what now we call the must is now wine, is going to go right into a wine press to separate the juice, the wine now, from the skins. So once it goes into a press, what you're doing is you're separating all the wine, comes out one end, all the skin staying inside the press, and then we barrel down all the red wine, which is very young and juvenile and almost abrasive and angular, needs to soften up and age. So what we're doing is introducing oak, and all the wine gets barreled down, and that's when the wine sleeps for, so it depends on what varietal, but it can be up to, 6 months, 8 months, 12-month aging, 18 months. I have some wines in the barrel for 33 months, and that's pretty much the longest I've had wine in a barrel, about three years.
Is it fair to say that many of the red wines have a more complex flavor, or because of that duration and the various things you've just mentioned, or do white, can whites have similar complexities?
Well, I would say for the most part, red wines are definitely more complex and are also good for you. It's good for your heart, is what they say. And the red wines, in small doses, one glass a day. We're out here in the wine country, we're probably more concerned with our liver now, but that's just part of our business. We're tasting so many great wines, and red wines definitely are more complex, have more layers going on. They have more richness on the palate. They have enough structure to be aged for several years, where white wines typically you want to consume at an early age. Red wines can definitely improve a lot more in a bottle. That's a whole other subject there, bottle aging and storage. But red wines, for the most part, are going to give you more layers. They're going to give you more tannins. That's a key word there. The tannin in wine is derived from the skin of the grape, also found in the stems, which aren't used, and the seeds. And tannins give a wine backbone and structure and ageability.
Hmm. One of the things that I enjoy when I come to Sonoma is visiting wineries, doing tastings and so forth. And some wineries offer tours of their caves. And I know that that's not where you guys have, but you probably have been to some of them in your time here in the wine country. Tell us about these caves and what do they do and why are they there? What's the story with them?
A cave. Wow, I love the caves. I definitely have been in my fair share of caves out here. And the caves are the ideal storage for aging wine, and a cave is going to offer a constant temperature, which usually is right around 55 degrees all year round. And a cave, no natural sunlight there. So what you're looking at is a constant temperature, no natural sunlight, and there's just a perfect amount of humidity that really is important when aging wine. So, you know, out here, there's a lot of excavation that has occurred on the side of the hills, and I've seen some pretty extravagant projects out here when it comes to the caves. But that's where wine thrives and loves, and that's the perfect environment to store and age wine.
Hmm. So it probably goes back to, I guess the Europeans must have had caves. It was probably before refrigeration or temperature control. It probably just was a necessity to find a constant temperature. I'm guessing where it came back, originally dated back to.
That's exactly correct, Rick. That goes back to hundreds of years before there was any refrigeration. And sunlight and also heat are enemies of wine. So you always want to have wine in a nice, cool, constant temperature, especially mm-hmm. during production, because you could introduce so many types of microbial activity, which goes into a lot of lab analysis, where you can get some funky wines and you don't want any funky characteristics when it comes to quality wine. So yes, definitely eliminate oxygen off the wine and eliminate any heat and you're going to be in a better direction there.
Mm, okay. Well, in a minute, I want to move on to things, tasting wine and what people should look for and so forth. But I think it would be a big miss on my part if we didn't utilize your knowledge and talents as a winemaker. And there's probably not enough time in a week to talk about all you do and all you know. But for our listeners to understand what a winemaker, what is it you do? What is it you have to know how to do and what you look for with the process of making wine? Is the blending and the aging and all that, what you work, the art that goes into it. Can you give us an explanation of that?
Yes. Yeah, balance is a word that comes to mind when you're talking about winemaking. You have so many different components to balance, and just some of the most important would be acids, your tannins, your fruits, your alcohol. Those right there are probably some of the main components of wine, I would say. And as a winemaker, what you're doing is you're starting off in a vineyard. You have to start with the grapes themselves. And what we're doing is we're out there. I would say one of the most important decisions from the winemaking stance would be determining the date of harvest. So that right there is going to tell us when the wines are ready to, or when the grapes are ready to pick. So we're out there in the vineyards, and that's where it really starts. You have to harvest at optimum ripeness, and there's a very small window that we have. And what we do is we measure the sugars on a scale. It's used with an instrument called a refractometer, and we have a scale that measures degrees Brix. So every degree Brix is pretty much a percent sugar, and we're looking for that 24, 25 degrees Brix. That could be considered a little high for some varietals. I know 23.5 is a really nice sugar there, and that gives you about 13 or 14% alcohol. So it really starts right in the beginning with the grapes. And then from there, our job is to just monitor the fermentation process and really make sure that we don't do anything wrong.
Yeah, it's a delicate process. I think the word balance is a good one you said. That's it's an interesting choice of words.
Yes, yeah, I'm not quite sure how much more in depth you'd like me to go into what we do out here in winemaking. Definitely an art and also a science, but our job is to really just showcase what each grape offers from that particular soil, and really all we're really trying to do is put it together in a way that's going to show you what Merlot tastes like from the Sonoma Valley, or what Cabernet Sauvignon tastes like from the Alexander Valley.
Mm, okay, that really helps. I mean, it's probably a combination or cross between being a scientist and being an artist and a chemist. Maybe
yeah,
a little bit of
definitely.
Chemist running there and farmer.
Oh yes, yeah. Viticulture is the art of grape growing, and enology is the study of winemaking. And I know some of the best winemakers are what I call wine growers, and they're really out there in the vineyards constantly.
Okay, cool. So let's transition this over now to what people look for when they taste wine. I mean, someone decides to give it a whirl, they go to a wine shop, they come to a winery, and they say, let me try that one. What is it people should look for when they taste a wine?
Now, this is the fun part of the conversation here, and this is really what I enjoy the most. We also refer to this as a sensory evaluation, also known as a organoleptic analysis. So,
okay, I'll remember that one, that term.
yeah, your olfactory receptors, of course, are telling you what you should pick up, and 75% of the taste of wine, believe it or not, is in the aroma and the bouquet, where that only leaves, a small percentage on the actual taste. So I'll kind of start off, and I'll get into, just as simple as when you first pour yourself a taste of wine, you always want to have a good ounce or two in a glass for evaluation purposes. You're not trying to pour a whole entire glass, so you want to start off with just maybe an ounce or two. And the first thing we always like to do is look at the wine. The appearance of the wine is very important. And when it comes to white wines, what you're really observing is the clarity. For Sauvignon Blancs and Chardonnays, when I look at a wine, I hold it up to the light, and what you're looking at is the fact that there shouldn't be any suspended particles, any cloudiness, any haziness. And we put the wines through fining trials and also filtration, and you get what we call brilliance. And that appearance right there, it should just be as simple as a visual appreciation, no more than that. I know a lot of folks, when they look at red wines, what we do is we use more of a white background, and we tilt the glass about 45-degree angles away from us, and you're looking at color extraction when it gets when you get into reds. So more color extraction for red, more clarity when it comes to the whites. And again, just a visual appreciation right there. So that's where you start with. There's a few different steps, and we want this wine to be appealing to all your senses. So the nice visual appreciation is really looking at the color. And a rule of thumb when it comes to reds, the darker the appearance, the bigger, the richer, the fuller the body. So the lighter the appearance, such as a Pinot Noir, usually softer on the palate and lighter on the body. So appearance is the first, and then you would go into the nice aroma. So anytime you take the nose of a wine, very important step. The most important step in a wine tasting is to introduce oxygen to the wine. You want to swirl, swirl, swirl. You want to volatilize your esters is what we like to say out here. So, yeah, esters being the organic compound in the wine, when exposed to oxygen, have the ability to release an aroma. So all we're doing when we swirl is increasing surface area, exposing more oxygen to the esters. So what you're doing is get the wine up on the side of the glass and swirl till your heart is content. You can never over-swirl. And once you you introduce the oxygen, you're going to get a lot more vibrant flavor aromas coming out. So we place our nose right in the glass. So many times I see people smelling the wine like it's a chemical or doing the brandy sniff, and you really want to get right in there. You got to place the nose right into the glass, and you take in that nice aroma. The aroma is usually associated with the flavors of the grape, the varietal characteristics, and the bouquet can be associated with the flavors that you get from the barrel, the nice oak and toast and some of that espresso bean tobacco and some of those nice bouquets there. So, your nose is going to tell you what you're about to taste. On the palate, we have the ability to taste sweet, sour, salt, and bitter flavors. Well, there is no salt in wine, so you're only really relying upon three actual taste buds. And the sweet taste buds are found on the very front of your tongue, which will pick up a lot of the wine's fruit flavors. On the side is where your sour taste buds are located, and that's going to pick up the acids in the wine. The Sauvignon Blanc, again, gives you that nice crisp authority. You know, that's a great example of acid in wine. It almost makes the mouth water. The bitterness is detected on the back of the palate, and that's going to be associated with the wine's tannins. So the dryness that you get, that bitterness is a taste, and the dryness, that astringency, that's a mouthfeel, and that is found on the back of the palate. So just a quick overview here. You have your appearance, then you get into your aroma, and we just discussed the palate. The last of the components that you're looking for is the finish in a wine, and that's pretty simple. That's the aftertaste. And with a nice, big, rich, full-bodied Cabernet Sauvignon, you're going to have a lengthy linger. It's going to finish for about another 25, 30 seconds on the palate, and that's pretty much it. Appearance, aroma, palate, and finish are the components that I look for when I'm tasting a great wine.
In fact, when I taste, one of the things I try to do to try to discern the flavors that I either the aroma and then after the taste, I'll typically close my eyes and exhale through my nose with my mouth closed to see what flavors I can detect. It's something a little thing. Right after a sip, I'll try that, and just it seems to help me a little bit anyway when I'm trying to detect and enjoy the wine and thinking, what does it taste like? What does it remind me of? How do I feel when I've just tasted this? It's very experiential.
Yes, yes. So you made some really good points there. Yeah, by losing your sense of sight, you're actually heightening your other senses there, and the breathing technique is described as a. That's a professional wine, advanced wine technique. If you breathe in through the lips and exhale through the nose, you're sending all those flavors up into that olfactory receptors, and you're detecting some more subtle flavors. And that is really a nice technique to do. I also like to draw in a little bit of air through the lips. While I have my first sip, I can breathe in a little air through the lips, and it creates a slurping sound which some people may not feel comfortable doing, but believe me, it is acceptable when evaluating wines. And you draw in that air, and the temperature in the mouth, of course, and more oxygen is going to change the components of the wine. It just gives it a lot more pop, and it's more explosive as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I've kind of encountered with talking about wine and drinking wine and tasting wine is people do get intimidated by all this. And, you know, just someone who's not had a great deal of experience with wine or may not just happen to know a lot about it yet, they think that, you know, they're embarrassed because they either don't know how to describe it or they don't know how to pick a wine. I know sometimes I'll be out to dinner with folks and they'll immediately just hand the wine menu to me, the list, because they think, well, you know a lot about wine. Well, I mean, sure, I've had the benefit of trying different wines, so I have a point of reference. But if someone, I mean, first of all, I always tell folks, drink what you like and don't worry about what people think. And if you don't like something, it's okay to say, I don't care for that. That's a somewhat subjective personal opinion or preference. I mean, you can like broccoli or you don't like broccoli. It's very similar to that. But I think what sometimes people get uncomfortable with is they don't know how to choose the right words to describe a wine. And it's not, in my opinion, this is not a matter of a snobby thing, being a wine snob, where you, if someone can't describe a wine in certain terms, that they shouldn't be talking about it. But I think where I'm going is it might be helpful to some of our listeners who are curious, what are the terms or the words you might use to describe wine when you taste it? And so you don't have to be an expert, but a few well-chosen words might help you through the process of describing it. So how would you guide somebody, Darius, if you wanted to say, here are the words you hear most often after you've had the sight, smell, and the taste?
Yeah, Rick, I think you hit it right on the nose there when you said that, you know, you got to drink what you like. And wine is, it's very subjective when it comes to describing wines. Everybody's senses can pick up different flavors, and we all have different preferences. I know that some people, only drink white wines, while others will only drink red. And my personal philosophy is I don't like to miss out on anything. So, you know, for me, you know, even if I had the worst Mourvèdre ever, I always know that Mourvèdre is a red wine. It's a red grape, and it's usually found in planted in the south of France in the Rhone Valley. And, you know, I'm not against tasting other Mourvèdres. It varies vintage to vintage, producer to producer, appellation. And that's such a loaded question there. What do you, to describe wine, I would say go with what you really feel, what you like on the palate. What are you looking for? Are you looking for something refreshing? Are you looking for something that has some nice richness that you want to bring to a table with a nice steak or something? Here's something that comes to mind for me. Wine and food is a perfect marriage. And when I'm tasting wine, I'm thinking of foods that I want to have with it. And vice versa, when I'm having a wonderful food, I'm thinking of what wine would go good with it. And the rule of thumb is to just have your wine not overpower your entree, or your entree not overpower the wine. And it's a lot of experimental. You want to do a lot of tasting, and you got to just play around with it. I'm not quite sure if I answered that question there, but
I think you did. I mean, it, sometimes people, you'll hear people say the words, well, that seemed very full-bodied, or that, you know, it seemed this or that. I think what you're saying is trust your instinct. Use words. Just talk casually with friends about to describe what it is you're experiencing or sensing, and it can be just your own words, but it'll just be an expression is really what it is.
Right.
I think the point about
exactly.
Tasting. Yeah, I sorry to interrupt you there. When I was preparing today's show, go ahead.
Oh yeah, you know, I would just wanted to add that we can also relate it to another liquid we're all familiar with. You know, if you have a fat free or a 2% or whole milk or whipping cream, those are all the same ingredient but different textures on the palate. You know, and the same thing with wine. You can have a light wine, light body. You can have a medium body. You can have a full-bodied wine, and it really comes down to what does your palate look for. You know, there are no wrong answers when describing wine. We definitely have a wine vocabulary when we're talking about fruit and sweetness and tannins and acids you know, when it comes down to it, it's basically drink what you like. There's only two kinds of wines in the world, I say, wines you like and wines you don't.
that's a really good one, and I have to agree with you because I have opinions about certain wines that I enjoy, and I don't really give a fig whether something is white or red. If I'm having fish, I typically will drink white, but sometimes I'll have a nice Pinot, and if it's what I'm in the mood for, I don't care, and I drink what I like, and so it's really people shouldn't get caught up with either what someone's going to think or say or with what the rules are. You drink what you enjoy.
No, exactly.
So I have to ask you a couple questions about Ledson here because I've been a Ledson fan. I have a bunch of Ledson in my wine cellar at home. And just tell us a little bit about Ledson Winery. And I want to talk about some of the wines that you guys produce also, but just a little overview if you would.
Oh, yes. Just to give you a little bit of my background, I've been in the industry now for 10 years, and every day is just a learning process here. I really enjoy the wine business because it offers the interaction with the land. You know, you're connecting with the art, with the science. You're connecting with the people. It's about the relationships. And Ledson Winery brings all that together for me. I started back in the year 2000 as a cellar worker, and I was pulling hoses and cleaning barrels and cleaning tanks just loving it, loving every day. And I started my formal education out at Napa Valley. They have a college there that offers a program of viticulture and winery technology. And I got to tell you that I learned quite a bit by just being hands-on. Well, 1 year after being totally immersed in the industry, I discovered Ledson Winery located in Sonoma Valley. It's about a short 1 hour drive north of San Francisco. And Ledson, Steve Ledson is the owner. He's also the winemaker, produces about 35,000 cases a year, and it's all ultra premium. We are making several different wines. I think the last time I counted was up to about 77 different wines, and they're all small production. Our average case production of each varietal ranges from about 200 to about 500 cases.
Wow.
And that's pretty small on the large scheme of things there. But Ledson Winery is right here in beautiful Sonoma Valley, right up in Kenwood, and it's a 16,000 square foot architectural showpiece that is an amazing place to visit. I enjoy working there. I'm right on the third floor, so I'm way up at the very top. There's four levels to this beautiful building. And we offer daily tastings Monday through, 7 days a week from 10 to 5. And you can come on in and visit us and taste some great wines.
And so I've been to Ledson a number of times. And like many wineries, in whether in Sonoma or Napa, there's a couple ways you can do it, right? You can walk in and you can go to the wine bar, I guess, and you let them know what kind of tasting you want, and there are different quantities or flights. So how does that work? You pay a nominal fee to taste if you want.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. You just come on in, and I think right now our current lineup of the tasting menu, you can have six wines for a $15 tasting fee, or you can go with the nine wines for $20. We have, I believe, there's probably a choice of about 25 or 30 wines on our daily menu. Or you can go with the winemaker's pick of the week and you pay $25 and the wine consultant will take you through everything. And that's really a nice way to explore Ledson. But the best way to explore Ledson wines is to call ahead and schedule a private sit-down wine tasting, which would be held upstairs in one of our nice suites. And you do a flight of all the best of the best of the reserve wines, and it's a private tasting. You're behind closed doors. You have one wine consultant that will take you through each wine in a little more detail. We also offer nice gourmet cheeses And it's just quite the experience. That's what I do on a regular basis, and I feel that that's the best way to really enjoy wine, to go upstairs, have a seat, sit down, and pull some corks and see what you think.
And yeah, I mean, I've had the benefit of doing a couple of private tastings with you, and not only are you knowledgeable, but you have fun with it too. You're able to talk, you sit down and have a conversation. And I've been with a variety of different kinds of friends and business colleagues who know nothing about wine, and some who've known a lot about wine. And in every instance, people walked away feeling really positive, comfortable with that experience, and it was just a lot of a learning experience too. So I would encourage people to go the private tasting route, and you know, you walk away buying a few bottles of wine or a few cases, and you take them home, and some of them you can drink right away, some of them you hold on to and you let them mature and age and develop, and it's so great to think back to that experience you had at a winery. I mean, I'm fortunate because I live in California, so I can get to this area a little more frequently. Some people only get here once in a lifetime. So if you plan a trip to Northern California and you want to have this incredible experience, go to a winery, and if you go to four or five, pick at least one where you do a private tasting and have that experience. What are some of your favorites, Terry? What, if you had to think of all the wines out there that you enjoy, what are your favorites, your picks?
Oh, wow. For me, I love the big reds, Rick. Any type of Cabernet, Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc blend. You know, I'm a big Bordeaux drinker. When I say Bordeaux drinker, I don't really mean wines from Bordeaux. I'm referring to wines made in the Bordeaux style, which in Bordeaux, the five main grape varietals would be Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cabernet Franc, Malbec, and Petit Verdot. And those pretty much are planted out here now. We have so many different wines, and when you ask what are my favorite wines, that's a big question there. I would have to go with a wine that we make. It's called Ti Amo, and that's an Italian word that means I love you. And we have a vineyard that we lease from Alexander Valley. It's called the Murray Ranch. It's up there on Chalk Hill Road, and it is just ultra premium. It's from a hillside vineyard that's located 1,500 feet above the valley floor. And this is my dream vineyard. If I could have one vineyard, this would be it. And this is all facing the south. You get that southern exposure, which is just perfect for ripening the fruit. And you get that excellent drainage in the soil, so the roots really have to work hard to get all that intense flavor. And the color, just the berries are small and tight, so you get a real good juice-to-skin ratio. And when we crush those grapes, the color just comes out dark and inky, and you get all that richness on the palate, and it's a fantastic wine. So one of my favorite wines is called Ti Amo. It's an Alexander Valley blend that we call a Meritage blend. That would be one of my favorite wines right there, Rick.
Okay, good.
And I know that you know about the Ti Amo. We definitely have enjoyed a couple bottles together.
It's good stuff. It is one of my favorites. In fact, I've got a few bottles in my cellar at home, back in Palm Springs, and I'll open up the door and I'll stare at the bottle and I'll think, no, not yet. We've got to wait. I've got just a couple left and I don't want to waste them, but they're really, it's a beautiful, beautiful blend.
The 02 and the 2002 vintage.
2002?
Oh, okay, I'm sorry?
No, that's great. Well, do you have any inside tips into some of the really great vintages at Ledson that somebody wanted to really splurge and get a great, whether it was year or one of the wines that you make that you think is just, you know, El Primo, top of the line, what would you, are there two or three you'd call out?
Oh, yes, yeah, no, for sure. I think I got ahead of myself there. That's a great question, because I was thinking, well, if you have an 02 Ti Amo, that is the best wine that I probably have ever had, the Ledson Alexander Valley 2002 Ti Amo Meritage. And if I had to go with one of my favorite years, besides the 1997, which everybody knew was the year of the decade in the 90s, I think the 02 was the next best thing. And we also make a Zinfandel that I have to tell you guys about. It's a Sonoma Valley vineyard, and we call this Ancient Vine Zin. And this Zinfandel was planted back in the 1880s. It's over 125 years old. And Steve Ludson owns this property right down the road here on right off of the historic Sonoma Plaza. And these vines were planted back in the 1800s, the late 1800s, and they're still on their original rootstock. And we get less than 1 ton per acre, and they're just gnarly-looking vines that are all head-trained. And talk about intensity, talk about layers. That this is a great example of what Zinfandel tastes like in Sonoma Valley. And also 2002, that is one of my favorite wines. We don't currently pour these in the tasting room, but we have access to Steve Ledson's personal cellar, which we definitely encourage folks to ask about if you're up here in the wine country.
Well, that's great. Those are great tips. I appreciate you sharing those, Jerry. Before we go, first of all, I want to thank you. It's been a pleasure having you on the show today. I couldn't think of anybody I'd rather have broadcasting live from Sonoma. I couldn't think of anybody I'd rather have on the show today to talk about wines. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Rick. That's very nice.
I do want to give you a chance to plug anything you'd like to, but I want to call out that, first of all, Ledson Wineries and Vineyards is ledson.com. Go to ledson.com. But you have a sister winery, Zenahide Cuttingham. Is that right?
Yes, Zenahide Cuttingham, located up in Mendocino County, right off of Highway 128 in the lovely little town of Boonville, right across from the Boonville Hotel. You'll find a small little tasting room that Steve Ledson built. He is the owner, and Zenahide Cuttingham is named after Steve's great-great-grandfather on the other side of the family, and that wine is a 3,000-case production. It's very small, boutique-y, undistributed, and just excellent quality for a great price point. And Steve Ludson's taste room has been open now for about 3 years up there. And we also offer that here at the Ledson Hotel. I'm calling you from the Ledson Hotel today. And where I'm at is right here on the historic Sonoma Plaza. So we're located on First Street East, right next to the Sebastiani Theater. And we also serve the Zenahide Cuttingham wines here at this nice luxury hotel.
Right. So if people want to reach you, reach Ledson, they can find you online at Ledson.com. Facebook, I know you have a fan page on Facebook for Ledson and also for Zenahide Cuttingham. Do you recall the phone number for Ledson if they want to make an appointment?
Yes, you can call direct to 707-537-3820. That's my direct line. So what I would do is I'd have our assistant Julie. She books all the private tastings. But if anybody wants to call in and just mention this this radio show here, then I'd be more than happy to personally put together a nice VIP reserve wine tasting for you.
Wow, that's really generous of you, Jerry. I really appreciate your time today. Jerry Padilla from Ledson Winery in Sonoma, California. Appreciate your time today, and thank you so much for calling in and joining us.
Thank you, Rick, for having me.
Okay, great. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
So, what a treat for us today to have Jerry on the show. He is an expert, as you just heard. And the thing I really like about going to Ledson is not only do they have great wines, but they have really knowledgeable people who can speak about wines without without being intimidating. So you can really have a nice conversation with somebody about wine that you'll take away from and feel really good about. So I highly recommend checking out Ledson. Before we go, I just want to let you know that we do have some more information today on my blog, rickrothfield.blogspot.com. You can find a post today with some information about wines, and I have a series of posts of I call them Exploring Wine series. And so I've got five or six different posts there, so please go check it out. If you want to contact me, you can send me a tweet. Send me a tweet on Twitter at Rick Rockhill, all one word, or rickrockhill@msn.com. So you've been listening to the Palm Springs Savant and Company radio show right here on Blog Talk Radio. This week we're live from Sonoma, California. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show, and see you next time on the Palm Springs Savant and Company.